Ray Saldanha showed how the quality of support depends on a sustained trusting relationship. Catherine Bradshaw and John Lockman showed us when group and individual interventions work, for whom and under what conditions. Eric Bruns takes us further still, into systems built for young people with the most complex social, emotional, and behavioral needs. Eric is one of the leading researchers and architects of Wraparound, an intensive team-based approach for young people with complex behavioral needs and their families. Wraparound is easy to misread as simple care coordination or as a meeting process. He helps us see that Wraparound instead is a value-driven framework for organizing help around each young person and their family's strengths, priorities, culture, and everyday reality. Eric helps us name two familiar problems. The first is fragmentation. A family working with several well-meaning professionals, each governed by a different funding stream and definition of success, left to coordinate themselves. The second is a failure to listen deeply, to recognize the relationships, knowledge, and other assets that families and young people already have that can help them address their challenges. Wraparound addresses both. A skilled wraparound coordinator helps a family and youth identify what matters most, build a team of professionals and natural supports to address what matters most, creates one coordinated plan, and revises that plan as needs change. The question shifts from which services can we refer this child to what combination of people, resources, and relationships will help this child and family move forward toward the life they want. Eric is careful about limits too. Values alone do not produce quality. A wraparound coordinator needs training, supervision, manageable caseloads, and access to flexible resources. If those are not present, an organization may use the wraparound name while leaving out what it takes to make wraparound work. As you listen, consider what unconditional responsibility would mean in your own setting. Not unlimited resources or a guarantee that every effort succeeds, but a refusal to make exclusion the default response when needs are difficult and progress is uneven. Eric, thanks so much for joining us. I have learned so much from you over decades. You and I first worked together on a monograph, Wraparound Stories from the Field, which tried to show what coordinated, family-driven, community-based support looked like in the real lives of children and families. That work described Wraparound not as a service or a program, but as a process grounded in values, community-based, individualized, strengths-focused, culturally competent, family-driven, team-based, flexible, connected to people's ecologies and natural supports, unconditionally committed, collaborative, and accountable for outcomes. This podcast episode, which includes multiple people, is about service alignment with an attitude, with inflection, because it's not just about aligning services, it's doing them in ways that are child and youth driven and connected to the world around them. So I want to start here.
That sounds like a great place to start. The values are where we want to start with this work. When we have leaders and we have practitioners who hold those values close, we have a chance of actually making better lives for families with the resources that public systems have to bring to bear. It takes a lot of other, as a lot of our research and our training in TA in states and provider organizations reflects that it takes a lot more than just holding the values close, but if you don't have the values being held close by your staff and your leadership and your supervisors, then all of the supportive and hospitable policies and settlement agreements at the state level and funding streams are only going to go so far. So I agree that we always start with the values and try to make sure that they're reflected in all the conversations that we have about the details of helping families in public systems. So it's a great place to kick off.
Yeah. And at the same time, while we're kicking off here, let me add that one of the important things that you have done, very consequential, I should say, is related to details grounded in those values. One of the reasons I thought that the wraparound initiative that you catapulted and led was so important was that in the field of children's mental health, there were many well-intended people who thought they had the values. And it's easy to embrace a value and then to fly the flag and to think you've done it. It's another thing to really walk the walk of those values. And that includes doing it in ways that ultimately bottom down to the details in every young person and in every family's lives. And so I think what you bring to us is that combination, which I think is very important.
Absolutely. I think that to the extent that I characterize myself as a researcher, it's my arc as a researcher has reflected those connected pieces of systems, practice, accountability structures that actually make good care happen, right? So, as you were suggesting, I think that the field when I was a care coordinator in the 90s, that was my choice of clinical internship when I was in clinical psychology training program with John Burchard. I did eventually have a placement as a therapist working within a wraparound-based system of care. But before that, I was a care coordinator, and that was where I learned really what the wraparound values were. And I think in the 90s, the idea of wraparound-based care on those principles of family-driven, youth-guided, collaborative, individualized, as you're suggesting, I think that was the primary goal that folks were trying to achieve. But it was interesting when John Burchard and I defined or developed the first fidelity measures of practice, how quickly it became apparent that you also needed to define what the working model would be of supporting that kind of principles-based practice at an organizational level and at a system level. And so we wound up kind of discovering implementation science by trying to get this radical idea of wraparound implemented out there in the real world. If you want to support that kind of practice that is individualized, family-driven, flexible, holistic, you had to have a real clear definition of what your organization that's implementing wraparound does, and the hospitable, what are the system conditions that need to be in place for that kind of care to happen? And that kind of, in a nutshell, is the reflection of the National Wraparound Initiative's development of tools and guidance for the field, as well as what we've been doing research on throughout the last 20 plus years on wraparound.
And from the get-go, you involve families and young people and on-the-ground providers. And there's a difference between telescoping in conceptually rich implementation science and learning the implementation science, connecting it to the theory on the ground up. And I think you did both, right? It was based in a university. It connected with people in universities, but it engaged families and if I correct young people from the beginning.
I mean, luckily, we were coming up and doing this research. Janet Walker, John Burchard, myself, many others who worked on this stuff with us. We were coming out of a really exciting time and context where the reflection of family and youth, full partnership with families and youth, was an expectation. And it became basically a non-negotiable that you could have a theory of change that sprung from observations by a researcher going out there and collecting data, observing practice, maybe even being a care coordinator or a therapist like myself. But when it came time to actually test those theories or even operationalize the pieces of your theory of change, it was absolutely incumbent upon you to have the group of individuals who were doing that definitional work, then maybe also doing the research itself, was a team of people who had tons of different kinds of lived experience. It couldn't just be the researchers, right? You had to have folks who had been out there trying to make that individualized family-driven care happen in the real world. It had to be parents who had to walk that walk with systems, oftentimes learning how systems were set up to fail them, for them to be the voice of, here's what the opposite would be. We need to do literally the opposite of what systems inflicted upon me and my children or my child. Those folks had to be there with you, and it was much richer product and much more creative process and much more high quality outputs because of that kind of collaboration. But it also meant you had credibility. And I think that's why X number of years later, wraparound going to scale still in many states out there as a practice model, as a organizing framework, while other kinds of evidence-based practices have come and gone.
When you and I and a few others organized and wrote wraparound stories from the field, we wanted to write thick descriptions of effective wraparound. And we went to system of care sites that had been identified by evaluators of as being the better ones. And we asked them to identify a real hard, challenging context and show us what wraparound looked like when it was being embraced relatively well. And what I'd ask you to do is we identified the effective characteristics then. It's the ones that the wraparound initiative very quickly was further operationalizing. Would you unpack them for people simply? We'll also attach some links for people, but so that they really understand the important components of effective wraparound.
One of the things, it was really cool that you're bringing up stories from the field, David, for a number of reasons. One, it was a great opportunity, and I really thank yourself, John Vandenberg, for bringing me into it. At the time, I was out of grad school for maybe 2, 3 years. I'd been with John doing research a little bit here and there on wraparound, but it hadn't really taken off yet. And to have one of the first products that reflected what is wraparound and what are the characteristics at a system, program, and practice level that make it happen? To have it be that monograph with, I think it was 5 or 6 stories from the field that zoomed in on a family and then reflected on what was it about the program and the system that made that success story happen. That was a really very, very cool opportunity. So thank you for bringing me into that. So many years ago, I remember having conversations with you and John Vandenberg about the vision for that while I was sitting at my desk in Baltimore as the evaluation director of the Family League of Baltimore City. That was my first job out of grad school. It had nothing to do with academia, but being invited into that and some other things around school mental health with Mark Wiest kind of gave me the idea that maybe I should pursue some of these kind of passions from an academic place. So thank you, first off. Another thing that's really fascinating about it, David, is I went to two places and did two of the stories. One was in Vermont, where I'd come from, and one was in King County, Washington. Little did I know, when I went out there to interview Bob Jones and others with the blended funding project here, Ann Vanderstoop was involved, who eventually became the person who brought me to the University of Washington. So there was some really interesting serendipity there. But going back to your question, one of the things that was fascinating, and this was the eye-opening piece for me, because I was not yet a researcher, I hadn't really thought about it in terms of a multi-level theory of change of what it takes to make high-quality care for kids with the most complex needs happen. But going back to that case study we did, that family story in King County, Washington, it was the blended funding project. The name of the project was one of the most critical system conditions that has to be in place if you really want to have care that is coordinated and individualized. You have to actually have systems that are working together and pooling their resources into one pot so that no matter what system a family or a child hits, they can be assured that there's going to be a care coordinator who can do whatever it takes across all the systems, across all the pots of money to get them what they need so they can live a better life. So it was very, I just thought it'd be cool to go out to Seattle. But when I came out here and I met Bob Jones, who was the director at the, I think, Public Health Seattle King County, or maybe, I don't know what exactly who his employer was, but he was the real visionary behind it. And Bob reached out to me recently and he wanted to know a little bit about where Wraparound had gone since the blended funding project, because his time doing that ended many decades ago and he's approaching the end of his life. And it was wonderful to connect with him. But anyways, just going back to the original question, I thought it was very cool to be able to tell the story of a family and a family organization that was resourced. That's another system condition that has to be in place that is rarely in place these days. But back then, it was something that people really, much more often than now, because we've been backsliding terribly on this principle, family organizations have to be an explicit partner and funded to be partners in overseeing the system of care, overseeing implementation of wraparound with families. And they're ideally, it's a family organization that employs and puts their family and youth partners into the care context with families. And that those are some of the conditions that were in place when we did that monograph here in the blended funding project in Seattle, King County, where I eventually moved to through completely separate pathways.
One of the, I was thinking as you were talking about that monograph and also learning from people on the ground, that in the, I only had the opportunity to do one of the case studies, and I did the Sacred Child project that was in on the reservation of the three affiliated tribes in North Dakota. And what was interesting there, because each one was very, very, each situation was different, and this was very, very contextually context was contextualized by the culture of the community, was people's feeling that the characteristics of wraparound that important theorists like John Vandenberg, Carl Dennis, and John Burchard had written about all made sense, other than that word informal support. Because to them, when a member of a clan is mentoring another member of the clan, that is part of a formal process. That's not just informal. And I think that what's also very important as people are learning from people on the ground is really also learning and appreciating how people make sense and utilize tools so that they really work for them.
Absolutely. Yeah, better than informal support, because that suggests that there's something lesser about those kinds of individuals in your life. Perhaps a better term that's sometimes used a little interchangeably, but I think the language means a lot, is natural support, right? This is helping one another is a natural impulse and a natural process. John Vandenberg had an exercise. Anyone who's listening to this, don't know who's going to listen to this, but if you're listening to this, just close your eyes and think of the biggest crisis that your family or you individually ever experienced. Think of the toughest thing that you ever went through as a family. And now picture the person who was most critical to getting you through that tough time. Put that person's face in your field of vision, in your imagination. When we do trainings, we have folks do that, and then we say, raise your hand if that was a professional, a therapist, social worker, a doctor. And then people always raise their hands. And then raise your hand if that was someone connected to you by family, friends, or faith. 90% of the room raise their hands. So why is it then that when we have a need for families with the most complex needs to get better, to stay, to keep, be able to live and thrive in their own communities and have parents and families who are able to support their kids to live better lives, that we do not look there first, when that's the way in which healing and hope happens, is through people connected to us by family, friends, and faith. We have fidelity measures, David, of the principles of wraparound. It all comes back to, are the principles of wraparound happening? And one of them is indeed natural supports. It's always the lowest scoring principle. And the programs and the system people wring their hands and say, I just don't understand why do we only have 20% of our teams have a meaningful natural support? What do you think, David? Why is that so hard to achieve when, as you learned at Sacred Child, in all communities, all cultures, that's the primary place that we actually get help to live and thrive? Why is it that when a system is called upon to reduce the rate of institutionalization of our young people and have hundreds of thousands of dollars sometimes being expended on one family, that we can't facilitate that kind of healing process being supported by those natural supports? What's wrong? What's going on here, David?
Let me take up the bait of your question because it's a really important one and share with you and the audience of what for me was a very meaningful conversation that took place when we were validating the National Agenda for Improving Results for Children and Youth with Serious Emotional Disturbance, where one of the initial five targets, not the final version, was wraparound. And in the design, I had to really validate, in addition to a lot of other work, we brought together three 2-day expert panels. The first one was of families and young people. The second one was of great practitioners. The third one was of researchers. And for each one, I wanted someone in the group who was a paradigm buster, who was not in the club. And for the one of professionals, I went to John McKnight, who, if people don't know, is really important because he and Jody Kretzmann are the people who are behind asset mapping. They developed it at Northwestern. And John had written this really seminal piece in the 70s or 80s called Professionalized Services in Disabling Help. And when I contacted John, he said, David, why do you want me to come to this? I don't know anything about children's mental health. And I said, John, you're the man. When we got during the first day of the focus group of practitioners to the target called wraparound, which was sacred to people, McKnight said, think about your language, the well-intentioned professional wraps services around children and families. Now, show me how that brings about change in communities. And I think the good news when it's done well, and you and the Wraparound Initiative have helped people know how to do it well, is people use wraparound and they're not wrapping it around in that way. More what happens when we're in bed and we pull the blankets and we decide when we want to wrap ourselves around in our own
I
cockamamie
like that.
matter.
I like that metaphor.
But what came out of that conversation, and we had a very painful dinner because he really hit a sacred cow within the field at that time, was we reframed it, and that target became collaborate with families. Okay. And it came out of that conversation about wanting to make sure that there were those services and supports around people, but not smothering them from above when what you really want to do is to support them from below and around.
I agree 100% that a skilled care coordinator who is given the tools and resources that they need, including training and coaching from people who are really wise and experienced about how to get from hello to help to healing, which is the way Pat Miles would describe what wraparound is, right? These are families who, more often than not, have seen the worst side of systems in terms of how they've attempted to get help in the past. And that's often why they've come to wraparound, is that helpers have failed them many times over. So having individual staff who are hired based on they're really holding those values that you started this conversation off with in their heart, but then being mentored and supported to actually bring that kind of vision to the way in which the helping process is going to happen, where they're encouraging and engaging in a way that reframes families' sense of their own positive future and indeed supports them to be able to pull the blankets around themselves and their child. That's when the magic happens. And the trick here is, how do we not have that be an accident of good social work when that actually happens? What do we do to put the conditions in place where it's as likely to happen as possible? And that's where some of the research comes in around co-defining what all of those conditions need to be to make that happen at a family, at the level of the family and their care coordinator and their team actually achieving that for the family, where they are indeed building that sense that they can build a positive vision of the future for themselves and their child.
There's a